The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
And it's the Anton Savage Show. I'm joined by Padraig Tobin, leader of Ain't Too Fresh From There or Desh, Paul Hosford, deputy political editor at the Irish Examiner, and Noreen O'Sullivan, former Garda Commissioner and Deputy General Secretary for Security at the UN. There is much that we need to discuss, ranging from Michael O'Leary on the cusp of netting €100 million in a bonus if all goes well for him, and James Brown apparently being made redundant by his cabinet colleagues, or at least being made effectively redundant because reports suggest that his power is being taken away from him. Before that, of course, the big issue of the weekend is those 50% tariffs. Business Post reporting Google chief commits to Ireland as Trump threat grows. And this is Sundar Pichai, who is saying that he is committed to Ireland, although the EU needs to look at its capacity in terms of innovation and tech support and change a lot of the way that it effectively regulates that out of action. But of course, there's also then the questions about whatever about the tech sector. What about the economy in general? Sunday Times, or rather Sunday Independent, saying 4 weeks to try to save Europe from all-out trade war. Emmett Oliver is with us. He's hard shoulder business correspondent. He's lecturer in the business school in Trinity College. Emmett, are we not effectively already in a trade war if we're going to be subject to 50% tariffs?
Yeah, I say good morning, Anton. Yeah, I would say so. I mean, obviously, we've had this China deal. I suppose what we're all asking this morning, and I suppose the papers are reflecting that as well, is what is Donald Trump's next step and what exactly is he doing? Is he just purely engaging in brinkmanship? And we will see an EU-US trade deal eventually over the next few weeks, and this is just all part of a negotiation ploy. Or the more gloomy assessment would be that this is going to be a long-term, persistent hallmark of his administration. We'll be backward and forward, and trade deals will be done, and then they'll be reopened again, and so on. So it's more as it depends which side of that you fall on. We don't really know, where he's going to go with this. We don't even know, actually, the pharmaceutical tariffs, which is probably the most sensitive from Ireland's point of view. We don't know, are they going to be wrapped into a general EU-US trade deal? Are they going to be coming further down after this latest spat? So we don't know the answers to a lot of these questions. And it does make planning very difficult from an Ireland government point of view. They really must be struggling to try and put a policy together in this. I see Simon Harris writing letters now to Howard Lutnick, the US trade representative. You kind of do wonder what effect any of that will have. So I do think there's brinkmanship here, Trumpian brinkmanship. But there's no doubt it looks like this summer is the period that the Trump administration have identified as when they want to get the deal. But Trump is saying he's already decided the 50%, it can't be changed, it's locked in. But then 10 minutes later, his Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent goes on television and says, well, it's really just a way to light a fire underneath the EU. So it's kind of tactical in nature. So you kind of bounce back between these two outcomes. So from an Ireland point of view, all we can do is probably really join in the general EU effort to try and get a trade deal. We want to be softer. We don't want big, harsh countermeasures against the US. That seems to be the Irish diplomatic position. But this will all happen in Brussels. It'll all happen in Washington. It won't happen in Dublin for the moment. And all we can hope is that the pharma sector in particular, which is the most exposed section, is in some way protected and insulated from what's going to happen.
And it's already having real-world consequences. There's reports that the uncertainty and that the flying of the kites around the tariffs has caused significant losses in Irish pension funds.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is, I've seen the story, but just to tease it out, it seems to be connected to, share prices coming down. And obviously a lot of people's pensions are in equities. Some of them would be in property and bonds and so on as well. But yes, that they will recover, though, presumably, if this all gets sorted out down the line, equity prices will come back. But yeah, if you're retiring soon, these are not headlines that are going to really kind of give you much of a boost to what your future retirement is going to be like. But I think the action is more in the area of what kind of deal emerges from this. If you look at the US-China deal, which gives us some kind of sense of what Trump might be playing here, they've come back down to 30% after going over 100%. The Chinese are sort of a little bit re-examining that. They're not happy with certain parts of it. So I think we're looking at just endless kind of continuous uncertainty that goes backward and forward, which Trump, I suppose, sees as a weapon. The more he destabilizes the trading partners, the more they're then on the defensive posture. So I don't think this is going to be all wrapped up and then there's a deal done in the summer and we never hear of this subject again. I think this is going to be some kind of a deal, some kind of piece of work put together between the two sides. And maybe next year, we'll go into another deal. Even the British deal that was done a few weeks ago, already bits of that are sort of coming unstuck. There's a lot of question marks about what exactly is happening there. So these deals don't seem to be cemented, and then the Trump administration moves on. So I just think we'll have to all live with the uncertainty of this new trade world that we're in. I know governments obviously want to lock in things. Businesses are dealing with a lot of uncertainty. I wrote a piece in the Sunday Times this morning asking a question about what is the Irish government going to do if, you know, some of these pharma plants start getting reshored to the US. I suppose that's maybe an intriguing part, is like, is the Irish government going to maybe pay some of the workers in these plants so that the plants are kept open during this very destabilizing period? Would the Irish government, for example, in some way invest money into the plants themselves so to keep them ticking over until all of this gets kind of resolved? So these are kind of questions that will come up in time. Obviously, nobody publicly is going to be reflecting on these, but we produce a lot of pharma that goes into Europe itself, never mind going on export to the US. So quite simply, a lot of people taking medicines and drugs throughout Europe are getting them because the active ingredients are made here. So, you know, no matter what happens with tariffs, there is that sort of day-to-day reality that a lot of people need this output and product of these plants. So they can't really be just shut down and turned off the way that the Trump administration seems to think they can be just reshored in a few weeks' time. So there's so many things in the pot here swirling around that it's going to be a complex and, I suppose, at times troublesome summer, I would say, both economically and for these particular industries.
Emmett, thank you very much. Emmett Oliver there, a lecturer in the business school in Trinity College. And what Emmett Oliver is suggesting about what we're looking forward to in the summer is reflected in quotes attributed to sources close to Taoiseach Micheál Martin, who the Sunday Independent tells us are saying that a bellicose statement a short time before the deal is done is common for the US president, so that, quotes, it looks like other countries caved into him and that he won concessions. And the Indo says, the source adds, we have to wait and see and not overreact to every new garish statement on Truth Social. Pathis, I mean, the problem is a lot of these garish statements on Truth Social are administration policy immediately afterwards.
Well, there's no doubt that Trump is the king of confusion, and there's no doubt that he tries to negotiate with a gun under the table. I think if you peel back all of this and try to ask, what is the US looking for here? It's clear that the US is a deficit trading partner, and that's their big problem. That's behind this whole approach. So what the EU has to do, and other trading partners has to do, is to find out how do you equalise the trade relationship in some way without destabilising our own economy here. My worry is that obviously Trump has a big dislike to the EU. There's no doubt that he doesn't want to negotiate with Ursula von der Leyen directly. We have actually a bridge relationship to a certain extent with the United States, between the United States and the European Union. And I think we should be not putting all our eggs in one basket with the EU in terms of negotiations, that we should be also negotiating with the States. And I'm not saying we have a side deal or anything like that. Obviously, trade is the EU competency. But we do need to make sure that we get up and close to the United States to protect our particular interests. I don't think necessarily...
But, you know, a lot of people have said stuff like this, Pather, and I don't quite understand how it works in real terms. If I'm Howard Lutnick or if I'm Peter Navarro and I am bullish in relation to the trade deficits that I see with Europe, how does having Simon Coveney, or rather Simon Harris, write me a sweet letter about Irish pharmaceuticals make a blind bit of difference?
Yeah, but obviously writing letters don't make a blind difference.
But even if I go over and sit down and have a chat to you, I say, well, it's lovely to meet you. Goodbye now. I'm going back to my original policy.
No, well, to be honest, actually, there's no such thing as a European-American or a French-American or a German-American voter. There is an Irish-American voter. So we do have leverage in relation to the US. And that leverage is very clear on St. Patrick's Day in the Oval Office. And we need to be using that leverage in relation to this. And, you know, what becomes the targets? What become the kind of retaliatory tariff targets in this is key. And actually, alcohol being on the agenda in the first place. Like, the European Union's objectives are governed by Germany and France and Italy in the main. And while their suite of retaliatory targets here are not necessarily that bad for Ireland at the moment, having alcohol there in the first place is damaging for us. The other point in this is really important. We are the most exposed country in Europe. We have a significant trade with the United States, nearly as much as with the whole of the EU. And, you know, I believe that this needs to be a step change in terms of how we run this economy. We do love FDI, foreign direct investment. We need to nurture foreign direct investment. But we really need to start looking at our own indigenous enterprise far more. Like 40% of the corporation tax that's paid in this country is controlled by about 10 CFOs, chief financial officers, determine what would be an enormous hole in our budget. So we need to make sure that that exposure reduces over time. And the way to do that is to grow indigenous business.
Now, some of that is long term. I mean, laudable notion, but takes a long time to do it. In the short term, Noreen, we at least now have some kind of precedent set because we've seen what other countries have done in respect of the tariffs being slapped on them. And it seems, maybe I'm being naive about this, but it seems that only the Chinese found the correct way to do it, which is ignore all of the language and immediately respond in kind.
I think there's one thing that we have to remember. The European trading bloc is a very big trading bloc and isn't exactly powerless in all of this. So I think the stance that the European Commission and the European Union will take on this is going to be really, really important. And also, you know, if this trade war, or if it blows into a full trade war, I forget who coined the phrase, but, you know, the mutually assured destruction. And that's what we're going to achieve. But I think at the end of all this, and just listening to Emmett's clip there around the uncertainty and the unknown, and that's certainly true. It's most uncertain, most unknown. But at the end of this, it's consumers on both sides of the Atlantic. And if we look at consumers here in Ireland and in Europe, but also consumers in the US, and particularly, I think when it comes to pharma, you have people who are dependent on medicines that are parts of the product that are produced here and then can be bought in the US and here in Europe.
So the difficulty is these are the appeals to logic that used to work. Whereas when you now look at Trump saying to Walmart, eat the tariffs, you're just going to have to put up with things getting more expensive. The old logic no longer pertains.
But I do think there's an opportunity for the EU to take a stance on this because, you know, you do have to engage and you would like to think, but I agree, oh, logic doesn't pertain. And the mutual respect of diplomacy that actually would normally reign. I think the EU up to now and Ireland particularly have taken that stamp and even the letter. You know, it is part of the diplomatic process and how things are escalated. How much traction that's going to get on the other side of the Atlantic is really unknown. But I do think we have to think about the uncertainty and the unknown for consumers and particularly for the public at a time when there's lots of worry about what the future holds economically and every other way. What does that mean?
What, Paul, from your perspective, what are the challenge to Europe to act as a cohesive bloc? Because one of the advantages the Chinese have is an authoritarian state system where they can decide we're doing this, tough luck if you don't like it. We have to negotiate between 27 member states with competing interests in some instances. That has to be a very tricky thing to do in a potential trade war.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that you see that you've seen since the beginning of this tariff talk is individual countries looking for carve-outs. And we have it here with whiskey. We're saying we have to go back to the EU and we have to try and negotiate a carve-out. If you start doing that, every member of the 27 member bloc is going to look for a carve-out. If we get a carve-out on whiskey, the French are going to get a carve-out on champagne.
Germans and, on cars and motorbikes.
And eventually you end up with no leverage because everything's protected, everything's off the table. I think one of the things that does damage this or makes it more difficult is not knowing what your negotiating partner wants. I think anyone who has kids will have been in the situation where your five-year-old is having a meltdown and they're tired and they're overstimulated and you say to them, what do you want? What would make this stop? And they say, I don't know. They're cranky and they've no end objective. So you can't negotiate with that.
But that goes to Pather's point about the deficit. Mm. The problem is, I think we're in denial about what they want. What they actually want is European consumers to not sell as much stuff into the US, European producers, to not sell as much stuff into the US as we currently do.
Yeah, so Donald That's Trump simple. wants to completely reorder the US economy in 6 weeks.
To
our detriment, but also to the detriment of his own consumers, and his own companies. He talked the other day about telling Tim Cook that you're just going to have to make iPhones as cheap as they're currently made in China. You're going to have to sell them as cheap as they're currently sold.
But how do we negotiate around that if that's what the intent is?
I think there's an element of it where you look at what the Chinese did and you say, look, if you want to go this road, we'll have to go. We will take the short-term pain because US consumers will not accept paying more for things. It's incredibly cheap to shop in parts of the US. Now, obviously, their grocery prices have gone up, but certain things are very, very cheap. When you go to the likes of Walmart.
Yeah, but do we have that leverage, though? Like, Pather, if you look at the goods that are in Walmart and that are hitting red state voters, they're not manufactured in Europe. We don't have the capacity to influence the way China does.
No, and actually one of the big things was that, you know, Trump was going to cancel Christmas potentially. Do you know what I mean? In relation to, you know, gifts, etc., being, you know, stopping from coming to China. I think the deficit issue is the biggest issue for the States. So the States is, you know, has an enormous deficit for trade. So how do you resolve that? One of the ways is around the dollar. So the dollar is overpriced significantly because the world uses it as a reserve currency. People are saving in it, they're using it to trade, etc. We have to find a way to reduce the value of the dollar to make US exports cheaper to a certain extent and more competitive. You're right in terms of, you know, there is major competitive problems with the United States vis-a-vis China and other countries, and they have to resolve that too. Regulations is a big issue, and you know, we have fantastic regulations here in the EU, and I would not like to see those regulations dissipate in terms of labour rights, in terms of the environment as well. But we have to find a solution in terms of those regulations to see how trade can be improved. Otherwise, we're going to get this belligerent, you know, aggressive attitudes from Trump. This is not new from Trump. He was talking about this 10 years ago. He is determined to go down this path. My instinct on this is not to go down the Chinese route, to be honest, is that actually de-escalation is the best route for the European Union.
I know I'm like a dog with a bone with this, but if we assume that this is a negotiating tactic with an intent of doing a reasoned deal, I can see your logic. Mm. But what he keeps telling us and demonstrating is that's not the objective. The objective is to make American consumers not buy as much stuff from Europe. And that's done simply by putting the tariffs.
Well, maybe that's a mistake. Yes.
Maybe the experience will be what we saw with the stock and bond markets. And maybe that will be the loudest voice that will actually draw his attention and make things change. So I think that's an area that we have to watch as well.
Yeah. He's not fully immune in relation to stocks and bonds. You know, we saw massive changes happening within the prices of stocks and bonds, and, you know, significant changes overnight in result of this. So, you know, at the start, there was this feeling that he was completely immune to diplomacy, to politics, to everybody, but he's not. If there's a cost
but
to the US economy.
But doesn't that argue for us taking a tough line on this?
See, I think this in game theory, there's two solutions to this. You could go down the Chinese route here, but that is a very risky, very high cost strategy. I think in our perspective, for Ireland's perspective specifically, actually the best retaliation is the least retaliation at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring things closer to home. There's a poll in the Business Post. It's the Red Sea poll that looks at performance of parties overall. Some minor bad news for Aintu. You're down 1%, but you're still within the margin of error. Disappointed?
No, well, listen, this is you go up a point, you go down a point on a monthly basis on this. One of the interesting things I've seen in this, though, is there is basically a view that there's an opportunity here for the Soc Dems and Labour. But, you know, I can go back to when I was young. Labour basically got about 10% of the vote way back into the 80s. And if you add Labour and the Soc Dems together, they roughly have about 10% of the vote still. So that vote really hasn't changed that much. In actual fact, the big change in the poll from now to about 5 years ago is the fact that Independent Ireland and Aintu are actually achieving around...
You're kind
you know,
of ignoring the spring tide and Eamon Gilmore's period. Like those numbers were very different.
For sure. No, there were two exceptions in reality to significant crashes of the two large establishment parties. They evened out very quickly in both occasions as well. But the significant change, you know, to the polls now and in that period of time is the 8, 9, 10% that are now voting for two new parties.
There's an interesting breakdown within it then as well in relation to housing. Paul, they were asked the question, would it be suitable to pay the new housing czar, who's going to run the housing activation, whatever the thing is called, would it be suitable to pay him a salary or her of €430,000, to which 70% of people have said effectively, over my dead body?
Yeah, I think, look, if you phrase the question like that, if you say, would it be suitable to pay somebody €430,000, I think that's probably a bit of a leading question, to put it that way. I think
I'm sure if I went up to somebody and said, would it be suitable to pay somebody more than €430,000 to run Ryanair, I'd get the answer. Yeah, it would be.
Well, I think, we'll probably get to that later. I think €430,000 wouldn't get the CEO of Ryanair out of bed. But I think what you see here, though, is the personalisation of spending of public money, was what happened with the Brendan McDonagh issue, where it became about his salary and him rather than about whether or not we actually need somebody to run this housing activation office, whether he was the right person, whether he had the skills. That was never discussed. I think towards the end of it, James Brown kind of said, oh yeah, like he's got a lot of skills, he will be able to corral this. Nobody ever really talked about whether or not he was the right person, that he hadn't come from the housing industry, that he didn't come from the utilities or the infrastructure sector, where he would have been able to say, look, and I said this in the room to the guys, I think if you came from a background where he undeniably had the skills, the salary would have become not necessarily a secondary concern, but it would have become less of a concern because you would have been able to say, although this guy's CV is bulletproof.
Surely you could argue that part of the skills that are required, a huge part, is the capacity to deploy capital and to understand the way the system works. He knows that inside out and backwards.
But that's not what we were told that this role is. This is about kicking in doors. It's about, you know, bringing people together, collaborating between utilities. It's about knowing the housing sector. It's about knowing local authorities. That's what we were told this was. And I think, you know, the handling of it, you know, it comes out in a Business Post report on a Wednesday. By the Sunday, we've learned his salary, and nobody from government has said this is the guy yet. It's not till the following Thursday where James Brown is on radio saying, "Yeah, this is my pick." So you've got 4 or 5 days of speculation, just really, really badly handled appointment. You could see him in the finance committee earlier this week, very annoyed at what had happened. Said nobody contacted him in between. Said that he felt himself he'd become a bit of a political football, which I don't think is particularly fair for anyone, regardless of their salary, to become particularly with something that they haven't done. If it had been about his performance in his job, and he, you know, if there had been
and
an
also
issue,
when the salary is theoretically for the role rather than for the individual, and you just go for the job, they're asked then whether or not there should be a housing czar, and it's a totally mixed bag. 35% ish saying yeah, there should be, 30% saying no, there shouldn't be, and 30% saying I don't know.
I think that speaks to the fact that nobody from the government ever said why this role was needed. It kind of hinted around, you know, bringing people together. The public did not get why we needed this.
Is it not self-evident to some extent? Because we see Minister James Brown writing to the local authorities now saying you need to get moving on planning process. Have we not seen for several years at this point that the multifactorial nature of what is clogging up our housing system can't get addressed through a single linear department?
I think part of it is around what Paul has just said around transparency. And I think that taking a transparent approach at this and maybe communicating why this is needed, because certainly from my experience looking across government departments and across the system, there needs to be better coordination, needs to be more effective coordination, and you do need somebody to whip everybody into shape. So I think that is absolutely necessary. But I think taking a transparent... I think it can be a minister, but actually I think the minister is in the line is actually the most accountable person. I think you need somebody at a level beneath the minister, accountable to the minister for actually making that happen. And at the appropriate level as well, to be able to whip into shape the heads of all the various agencies. And particularly when it comes to something as important as housing, because housing is really important. It's something that's affecting, if you look at the social impact and the anxiety, the mental health of people that are either in a rental market or can't even get into the rental market, and what that means for us as a society. And the Irish psyche, people want to own their home, or they at least want to have stability around a place rent. And I think what's really important is that actually it is prioritised by government. And if that means bringing somebody in at the appropriate level and having to pay them, but to be transparent about it and understanding what this housing activation department or whatever this system is going to be.
And paid them 400 and something thousand?
I think the amount is actually, and the way that the amount was presented, nothing to do with the individual, but actually that is an enormous amount of money. And particularly when you're looking at people who are on a very basic salary that can't actually get into a housing market, then I think everything has to be proportionate to that.
Pather, what I'll do is I'll come to you after the break, if that's all right, because I'm conscious that you do want to come in. Interesting text saying we already have a housing czar. It's called the Minister for Housing. We don't need two of them. And then a lot of response in respect of the tariffs. Trump must be stood up against and hit back with tariffs hard and fast. If we let Trump control us, they'll want us to sell their second class food in Ireland. And they'll also want our health services in Europe to become like the US. No social health care. Another, the EU should ignore Trump just like China. Pather, I'll get your reaction to where we're at with housing and all that after this break. It's the Anton Savage Show. More text coming in. If you give in to a bully, you get bullied. I learned that at school. That, again, relation to how the EU should respond to the US tariffs. I'm joined by Noreen O'Sullivan, former Garda Commissioner, Pather Tobin, leader of AIMTU, and Paul Hosford, Deputy Political Editor at the Irish Examiner. Before the break, Pather, you had a point you wanted to make.
Yeah, just in terms of this government approach to the housing czar, it does feel like that kind of Father Ted quote, you know, is there anything to be said for another L task force here, Father? Do you know what I mean? The idea of having to continuously outsource responsibility. Imagine these ministers stood for election and before the election said, listen, elect me, I'll be the minister. When I get elected, I'll give the job to somebody else to do. What's wrong with the minister having the technical knowledge themselves to do the job? And then there's another big issue here as well in terms of these salaries. These salaries are eye-watering, and I think there is a natural instinct in the Irish people that they don't want to see the upper decile, you know, have incomes that are significant multiples of the lower decile. Other European countries, like the Scandinavian countries, have a far more cohesive income distribution in terms of work. We do want people who know what they're doing, who are working hard to get properly paid. But some of these incomes are outstanding, and I think people naturally rail against that.
Now, that being said, Paul, I don't know if you saw this piece. How do you compare that then with the windfall that Michael O'Leary may be in for? Because if Michael O'Leary, I think it is that he has to keep Ryanair share price above €21 per share for another 6 days.
Yeah, 28 days in a row.
What does he net if he achieves that?
He unlocks a €100 million share option bonus.
Bonus on top of existing shares and salary.
I'm delighted for him. if he's looking for my Revolut, I can send it on.
But how do you square that then with, if that's what, and I know it is the extremes, it is one of our largest listed corporates and undoubtedly one of our most successful. But how do you square what the private sector can give people versus what the public sector gives?
I think with something like Ryanair, there's always a tendency for people to look at it and say, look, it's profitable, it does what it does, fair play. And I think with Michael O'Leary particularly, he's almost completely unashamed by it. So he doesn't carry that wealth with any kind of negative connotation. So I think people just kind of let him away with it. So there's no perception that this is a guy who's earning more than the average person, because he doesn't seem to carry himself that way. But yeah, it is funny that people have that disconnect and they say, well, in the private sector, you can earn unlimited money, more than anyone in history has ever really had, put you in the top, 1% of Irish people ever. But if you're a civil servant, you should be capped at 200,000 or 400,000 or whatever figure people arrive at. So it is an interesting disconnect.
Now, is there a problem in it in the system in that one of the things, Pat, that we can't really do well in the public service is award for performance? Because O'Leary is getting this share option because he's hitting specific targets agreed by the board that are used to present to the shareholders. If we did the same with the housing czar and said, right, every house you get built, you get a fiver, add them all up, you're going to make a small fortune. We're not good at that kind of thing.
No, I do think actually we should start to pay in the upper civil service in terms of performance. And, you know, I think that goes both ways. You do well, you get well paid. But if you cost the taxpayer massive money, there's also a penalty in relation to that. And I do think one of the problems in terms of public pay in general, that is we're locked into these public pay agreements that, if you want to pay Gardaí, for example, to get more Gardaí into the system, or nurses to get more into the system, you have to lift the income of everybody across the public service, which is absolutely the wrong thing to do in terms of recruitment. You know, if you want to recruit, you need to create a package that's competitive in that specific sector. And we're locked into those, which has the outcome of making sure we don't get enough Gardaí and we don't get enough nurses to do the job. You know, €100 million, though, is like, you know, I want people to do well and I want people to earn good money and be prosperous for the hard work that they do. But there is a question mark around what's happening in the world. You know, there is a concentration of wealth into the hands of fewer and fewer people. And that is a big question that we have to come to terms with as well. And corporation taxes, to a certain extent, allow for that to happen. You know, the wealth of the 1% internationally is now equivalent to significant levels of society.
But the counterpoint is people will say, look at the wealth that Michael O'Leary has generated through the growth of Ryanair for this country and beyond.
Yeah, no, listen, Ryanair is one of the most successful countries in the world. And Michael O'Leary is one of the most successful business people. And I wish him luck and I hope to do well, him to do well. But we do have to get to that question in terms of the concentration of wealth in the 1%.
But I also think, if I can for a moment, in terms of the public service, you want to attract the right people into the public service. And I absolutely agree. I think there needs to be accountability and there needs to be links to performance. But that has been tried for several years. And I think what Pather says is right about the terms and conditions of public servants. We can never match what it is in the private sector. There is always going to be differential there. But I think to have the proper terms and conditions that attracts the right type of people with the right type of motivation into the public service, and particularly at the higher levels, but also right across, as regards nurses, teachers, you want young people, and indeed some of our people that are in Australia and Canada and further afield in the Middle East, you want those people to come back here and to be rewarded if they come back and they're taken at the same level into the public sector and civil service.
Interesting text, picking up, Paul, your analogy earlier on about the five-year-old in respect of Donald Trump. Somebody has really doubled down on the metaphor. I reckon Paul's analogy of a five-year-old tantrum is bang on for Trump. When my five-year-old is like a bag of cats, I grab him for a big cuddle and we just sit for a while. Trump is the same. He needs to regulate his emotions after losing the last election and wanting to get even with the world. He needs a metaphorical cuddle to help him regulate. Behind closed doors, tell him how right he is about Biden, how mean it was that he was robbed of the last presidency, and how he'll be the best president in the history of the world. And give him a nice big shiny gift, pat his head, send him off with something that looks like a concession, but what is not really, and watch him go. He's a narcissistic five-year-old. The best diplomacy is to treat him as such. Not a bad strategy.
That's what he said.
Before we wrap up, speculation in respect of a number of appointments. We're beginning to get closer and closer to finding out who's going to get the two jobs that everybody is thinking about. One is the presidency and the other is Joe Duffy's gig on Liveline. As to the presidency, Paul, you're our political...
I was going to say you for both jobs.
Just a sniff of it. Just a sniff of it. I could do Liveline from the park. The park, Michael McDowell, who was predicted as a front runner and a very likely candidate and very transfer friendly in some of the polls, he's out.
Yeah, he ruled himself out on Friday. I thought that there was a chance he would go. He would have cleared the 20 members of the Oireachtas fairly handy. And I think you look at the polls, he definitely would have picked up a large number of votes. I think he would have been somewhere in around 20-25% heading into the election. I think one of the things that you're seeing right now is we're here in May and there's no general consensus on any candidate, anyone wanting to put themselves forward. Heather Humphreys also ruled herself out.
Why would they rule themselves out so early? Surely the being talked about is a good thing if you're a politician.
Well,
or an
I think
aspirant.
In Heather Humphreys' case, she said that she did think about it. She considered it, but her whole retirement was to spend more time with her family. And you don't do that if you're spending the summer going to every agricultural show trying to drum up support, because that's what's going to need that.
Yeah, but then you're 14 years doing not a whole pile.
Ah, yeah, but you're doing it in Dublin as opposed to in Monaghan, where she wants to be close to her family. I think there is an element of it that's it's nice being talked about. But one of the things that it isn't really focused on here is that a lot of political parties are leaving this really, really late because they're tapped out from last year's elections. And they ran Europeans, locals and a general within a couple of months, and they don't have the money to run a campaign all throughout the summer. So I don't think we're actually, I was chatting to people about this last week. I don't think we're going to see candidates, a full field emerge until probably September.
Meanwhile, the other gig, Joe Duffy's, Ciara Kelly is very much being talked about. She's on the front of the Mail on Sunday. Have I been approached about RTE's Liveline? I can't say.
Is that you, Anton, now, or Ciara?
No, I can say. Nobody wants me on Liveline. So the current runners and riders then for the Liveline gig are Katie Hannon, Philip Boucher-Hayes, and News Talk's Andrea Gilligan, and Ciara Kelly both being talked about. Is this going to be like the presidency? Is this going to run on now till September before we find out who's replacing Joe?
Well, you know, what I really think is there's a great opportunity with Joe leaving RTÉ to actually use that slot for the point of view of public service broadcasting to make it actually a meaningful way to engage with ordinary members of the public that have really important issues and topics that they want to discuss, and to do it in a really structured way. And I think about, for example, the Electoral Commissioner, Commissioner Chagón, the recent survey that they did and how people feel disconnected. And it's not that it should become a politics show, but actually to talk about some of the issues we've been talking about this morning, the real tricky issues that actually affect everybody's everyday life. And I think there's a great opportunity to do that. And whoever the person is...
Very difficult to do without Joe.
But I think there's a way to do it. And I think there's a lot of candidates, including yourself, Anton, that have been mooted as potentials.
Thanks very much.
And I think there's very good opportunity to actually really use that slot, that daytime slot, to actually shape up the conversation on real issues that are impacting on the public and on people, the length and breadth of the country. And I think it's a great vehicle to do that.
I think one of the worries that you have with something like that is it. You see it in football all the time. The manager who came after Alex Ferguson, when David Moyes took over Manchester United, tried to do things his own way, but also keep it simple and keep it to Ferguson's time there. You end up kind of being nowhere, and I think that would be the worry if I was if I was one of those names that was mooted. Is what can you do with the show afterwards? You're always going to be compared to Joe. Are you going to be given time to become yourself?
I think Louise Duffy did a really good job at replacing Ronan Collins. Absolutely. And I think the numbers bear that out. And I think there's an opportunity.
Folks, thank you very much. Appreciate your time this morning. That is Noreen O'Sullivan, former Garda Commissioner, Padraig Tobin, leader of AIM. And I have to thank Padraig for arriving in a tie. I think it's the first time we've had a tie in the room on a Sunday morning. And Paul Hosford, Deputy Political Editor at the Irish Examiner.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.